All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of Liberty Lens. I am your host, Big John, and joining me on this rainy day, and it's been kind of balmy and rainy all, month, all quarter here on the East Coast, seemingly, and we've both survived some power outages, so let's just go straight forward while we still have some power. All right, I am Big John, as I mentioned. Joining me once again today is my very capable and handsome host, Mr. Mike Termott. This way. Yes, Mr. Mike Termott right there, folks.
It's
Mike,
good to be with you. You may have me confused with someone else, but I'm here with you nonetheless. And a big shout out to the other Mike Termotts in the United States, at least a couple of which are actually pretty good looking.
There you go. There you go. All right. So, Mike, one of the things, and we bounced around a lot of potential areas to focus on this week on Liberty Lens, since we try to limit ourselves to one subject per episode, just to do a little bit of a deeper dive. And finally, we settled on something that has both immediate and far-reaching consequences, depending on how the policies our government enacts play out. And that is the national debt, the money that the United States owes to various creditors. Now, that takes the form of spending, that takes the form of treasuries and bonds and all that fun stuff. So this is where I clam up, unlike Christy Noem on the definition of habeas corpus, this is where I clam up and allow the actual economist to explain some of this for us. So the forum is yours, Mr. Termott.
Well, I appreciate that. It is true that the House of Representatives is presently considering and negotiating what they want to do for budget reconciliation, even when they eventually come up with a bill that they can pass out of the House, which is a tricky thing, right? Because they need to satisfy the White House and a majority of the House of Representatives, even though they only have a couple of seat margin and zero Democrats are going to vote with them. But assuming that they can negotiate their way through that, the Senate will still have to pass something with only a 50% margin, good for them, because they're following the reconciliation process as opposed to their typical process, right, where they need 60% to invoke cloture. The Senate still needs to vote something out that matches what it is that the House votes out. So undoubtedly, this will end up going to conference, a negotiation between the House and the Senate.
Right.
And unlike most circumstances, this will be a tight negotiation three ways, all of which are Republican. But having said that, I think that we can expect a couple of important things. One, you and I will be talking about this either next week or the week after.
Right.
To see what actually is happening and mark progress. The other thing that I think that we know is that there will be an extension of the Trump tax cuts enacted 8 years ago. And we probably know with some certainty that whatever the package looks like in its final form, it will, on a net basis, considering the tax cuts, increases in spending for defense and for border security and a few other things,
right,
net of some cuts, we have yet to see what that looks like for Medicaid, for example, and some other areas. But on a net basis, it is probably going to increase the deficit, increase the debt in the long run, as opposed to decrease it.
Yeah.
And that's relative to the baseline set of expectations, which is to say, if they didn't make any changes at all, the debt would be increasing anyway. But this package will increase the debt even more.
And faster.
And faster.
Right.
So this is a problem that you and I want to talk about.
Sure.
Because I think the correct context is, just last week, Moody's Investor Services downgraded their estimation, their rating of U.S. government federal debt in terms of its creditworthiness, from the top rating of AAA, which is enjoyed by not only the U.S. government, but some other governments and quite a few excellent, large, typically corporations in the United States.
Right.
Downgraded it from AAA to AA1 is how they express it. So it's only one notch out of like a dozen notches. So it's not to say that they assigned an immediate catastrophe to this, but Moody's downgrading of the U.S. government debt marks the third of the three major agencies who rate such things to do so. So now all of the agencies agree that the U.S. federal government is no longer a top-rated credit risk.
And listen, let me pause you on that, because for people who are not familiar with bond markets, with rating agencies, I don't want this to slip under the radar for folks like that, because literally what we're saying is that the nation that issues, up until now, the safest treasuries, perceived to be the safest treasuries, the safest credit, we have an obligation. You will get your money back.
The safest financial securities in the world.
Right. All three major rating agencies now have us at not the top rating. Now, that is critical in a lot of different areas, right? It means that for the U.S. to issue new treasuries, new bonds, they have to offer a higher, generally speaking, interest rate, where the market will have to offer a highest interest rate. Last week, we mentioned, like, what happens if you try to invest in Ukraine? Well, investors in Ukraine are going to demand 10, 20, 30% on their money because it's a war-torn area. It's likely not to have good information. Like, for all the reasons we mentioned, you have increased...
All of your viewers should consider, would you invest in Ukraine this year?
Exactly.
Would you invest in Russia?
Exactly. And that's why an investor will, if they decide to take on that risk, need to be compensated for that. They need to
get
a lot more. The U.S. can offer lower interest rates for their debt because people know, like, all right, we're not going to make a ton of money on this, but we're guaranteed not to lose our money. Even better, we're guaranteed pretty much to get paid what they say they're going to pay us.
I think most people have up until now considered, big-time investors and small-time mm-hmm. investors alike, I think most people would have considered up until now treasury securities to be the equivalent of a bank deposit.
Right.
With interest, you know, the same level of risk, which is to say virtually none.
Right.
But you would get paid some interest on it. And this is the way that we viewed it. When I was in school, John, several thousand years ago, when I was in graduate school in economics, it was not even a topic of discussion. Like, if someone said, well, treasury securities aren't zero risk, you know, the professor would say, for all practical purposes, they are. And if we're ever in a discussion otherwise, we're in a completely different regime. There's all hell broken loose. Right. None of what we're talking about matters. Like, none of the 11 courses you've just taken in finance matter.
Right.
It's, you know, Mad Max beyond Thunderdome.
Right. The thing, like, that I heard in my classes was, if it ever isn't zero, meaning the risk with treasuries, you've got a lot more to worry about than the interest, than the risk not being zero, right? So,
right. Something has gone wrong in your life.
Exactly, in everyone's life. So to that extent, before we get into the technical analysis of the debt, which there's a lot of numbers that are going to be floating around to all you nerds out there, you're going to be happy in a second. But let's just say this, right? Why then, when this downgrade by Moody's was announced, like you said, they were the last of the major ratings agencies to take this step. Why was it that Secretary Bessent, for one, went on all the Sunday morning news shows to say, this doesn't matter, it's a nothing burger? Why are people caring about this? We don't know. Why is a Soros-trained hedge fund manager telling everyone in this, the citizens of the U.S., that the downgrade of their sovereign debt is no big deal, Mike?
Because it does. It does matter because it is a big deal. Doth protest too much.
Mm.
The tell, the giveaway, is that the Treasury Department is talking down the significance of the Moody's downgrading, not even bringing up Fitch's downgrading of a few years ago, or S&P's downgrading quite a few years ago. If this didn't matter, he wouldn't have to be talking about it.
Right.
It does matter. In fact, and it was funny that you and I were talking about this a couple of days ago. I thought nobody noticed, and you pinged me by text. I was like, oh, thank God people are noticing. I believe that if this should go south on us, and we're going to talk about, you know, what are the things that could happen. If this goes south on us, the United States government faces a financial collapse in the future, whether that's, you know, 5 minutes or five decades from now. I do believe that the one volume textbook on what happened will have to include a mention of Scott Bessent talking about the fact that the Moody's downgrade didn't matter. That's how significant an event I believe it to be.
Yeah.
And the reason I think it's so important, two reasons. One is that it does matter, that what will lead to the financial collapse, if there is one, is a loss of investor confidence. In fact, I would argue it's the only thing that matters, right? All the numbers we're going to talk about only undergird the arguments of the investors who are getting cold feet.
Right.
But what matters is how cold their feet are. That's what matters. Even if their perception is incorrect, and I'm not going to argue that it is incorrect, but all that matters is their perception. So that's the first problem. And the second thing I think that's really important to talk about regarding our Treasury Secretary is that however you might personally feel about Moody's, however you might personally feel about credit ratings, however you might personally feel about the likelihood of facing a financial crisis, this is the one guy whose job it is to worry about that.
I was going to say, this is the equivalent that if, for the sake of argument, let's say Microsoft had a downgrading of its credit, this would be like Ballmer, Gates getting out there and saying, there's nothing to see here, meaning Bessent is, in essence, the CEO of the company that's issuing these bonds, that's issuing this credit. If you put it in the context as if it were a private company, this is the CEO of the private company coming out.
At the very least, the CFO.
Right, exactly. Saying, hey, there's nothing going on here. I don't know why people are upset that we're no longer as creditworthy as we were yesterday. And to your point, I know there's a lot that Bessent is trying to do to spin this politically. Like, hey, you know, this is just people not, you know, liking President Trump's actions and everything. But that's what credit agencies do. And to your point, it's not just Moody's. Moody's was the last of the three majors, Fitch, S&P, and Moody's, to say, we're not at the top of the heap anymore. There are actually private companies that are more credit worthy than the United States government. And to me, that, to your point, is extremely concerning for the future. Talk to me about two things. A, how this affects the debt, and which is the next point is going to be a subtext, because everything has subtext when it comes to the economy, how this affects potentially the United States dollar acting as a reserve currency, which in turn, maybe I'm giving it away, buttresses the strength of the dollar.
Yeah, it's everything. It's everything. And just to put a nail in the Treasury Secretary conversation coffin, not only is it we've lost, I have to edit that. Are you back?
Yeah, I was
sorry. Okay.
Yeah, I can see. Hold on. You know what? Start off from.
I'm going to start that answer over again.
Yeah, start off from to put the nail in the coffin. I think that's a great edit point.
Yeah. Imagine if you're the CEO and your CFO, your chief financial officer, comes in and says, "Yeah, you know, boss, I noticed that the credit rating agencies have downgraded us. But, you know, don't worry about it." I think the CEO's job is to say, you're fired. Right. You know, it's up to me to decide whether it's important. It's your job to make sure this doesn't happen. And it did happen, and I've got a problem with that. I can decide whether it's important enough. I don't want you deciding the fact that you can't do your job right. is unimportant, right? And none of us like to make mistakes. But if you make a mistake, the right answer isn't to go into your boss's office and say it doesn't matter.
Right.
The right answer is we're going to fix this. And when he goes on television and says the rating agencies don't matter, I'm sorry, that's the wrong answer. The right answer, if you actually believe what you're doing, and I don't. I think that the administration is on a very bad path, and I think the Republican Party is on a very bad flight pattern here. But if you were all about what it is that they're doing and you're right. defending it, the right answer is Moody's does matter. They got it wrong. I'm going to explain why they got it wrong, why you can trust the federal government to maintain its creditworthiness.
Right.
Right? You know, we're going to do X, Y, and Z to grow the economy. We're going to do X, Y, and Z to manage our debt. We're going to do these things to manage the budget. We're going to increase revenue or cut spending, I hope, as opposed to increasing revenue so that the economy grows faster. This is what you're going to talk about and make us feel better. Because when you say something as patently stupid as the agencies downgrading the government's debt doesn't matter, it makes it to people who actually understand this.
Right.
And this is not just, you know, nerds dancing on the head of a pin inside economics departments at Western universities. Right. This is actually a whole lot of people in New York who know how this work, who are going to demand higher interest rates when they buy treasuries from now on, who don't trust you. And the signal that you're sending by saying it doesn't matter is that you're too dumb to know that you've got a problem.
Or dishonest.
Or you're dishonest.
Right.
Neither one is a good look, right?
Right.
Neither one solves our problem.
You're right. But it does point out the fact that, I don't know, look, whereas you and I could argue whether the president understands these nuances, I don't think you and I could credibly argue, I would hope, that the Secretary of the Treasury doesn't understand these nuances. That's why I'm more leaning towards he's being dishonest. Whether he's being a loyal soldier or not, there's no way Scott Bessent can look anyone in the eye and say these credit ratings don't matter. The creditworthiness of the U.S. government doesn't matter. So he's being, in my opinion, he's being dishonest. Now, to what end is the question? To what end? Towards what goal?
That's well said. And, of course, the question always crops up, where is the dishonest? You know, is he just being dishonest with himself? He's in denial.
Right.
Probably some of that going on. Is he dishonest in his estimation of how much the economy is honest in the sense that it's not likely that markets are going to react by demanding higher interest rates? Is he being dishonest in the sense that he doesn't believe that, or doesn't want us to believe that debt is actually going to increase?
Right.
It's hard to know because he's not answering the question correctly. Just saying there's nothing to see here, well, there's actually at least five things to see, and I'm not sure which of the five he's trying to cover up. That's the problem, because it's not nuance. And this is why, by the way, this is why you want the Federal Reserve System to be completely politically independent of the White House, so that you don't get some silliness going on at the Fed. As dangerous an organization as the Fed is, as politicized as it is, as much as I wish the Fed were replaced by a rules-based system, the reason we feel that way about the Fed is because we want it to be less political, not more political.
Right.
And so, you know, there is an argument to be made here that you want a Treasury Secretary to be as independent from the White House as the Fed is, as independent as we used to think of the Department of Justice being from the White House, right? We used to think of the Department of Justice as being very, very independent of the White House. That's obviously not the case anymore.
Right.
But a lot of people believe that we have lost something when the DOJ is relatively politicized. And to your point, I don't think we can any longer trust the stuff that gets said by the Treasury Department. So in answer to your question about long-term implications, gee whiz, what, you know, the way this works is that a legal entity, whether that's a government or a corporation or a bank or a household or a dude, someone piles on too much debt,
right,
and they keep borrowing, and it turns out that they can't make their interest payments without borrowing more.
Right.
So you keep borrowing so that you have enough cash to make your interest payments, and all of a sudden someone notices. If you're big enough to get noticed, if you're a household, you're probably not going to get noticed, but sometimes you do, right? Sometimes credit agencies notice you're running three credit cards flat out, plus a mortgage on your house and maybe a second mortgage on your house. You know, this isn't looking good. Your credit rating plummets. And now the next time you go and you borrow more, it's going to cost you a lot more. Well, the problem is when people lose confidence in your ability to make your payments and therefore demand a higher interest rate when you borrow more.
Right.
That means that what it takes to meet your interest payments, you know, it's getting higher, 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 higher. All of a sudden people lose confidence in you. Your interest rate goes up and now, oh, there's hell to pay. Right?
Right.
It doesn't just go like this forever. There comes a tipping point.
Right.
At which people lose confidence and you are screwed. And we don't know. No one knows until you reach it. That's the scary thing.
Right. And to sort of back up what you said, upon announcement from Moody's, the Treasury rate went over 5%.
Yep.
It receded a little bit after that initial shock, but it went up. And here's what we say with these things. The day-to-day interest rate movement is also a function of demand and supply in the marketplace. Every day. Every moment. Every ticker, right? But the trend is that when the next round of treasuries come out, people are going to say you start out at that higher rate. So think of it as the old savings bonds we all had as kids, right? You bought them at a discount, but the government would have to give you the full amount. So if you bought, typically it was you bought a $100 bond for $50, it matured in whatever it was, I forget, Mike, 25, 30 years. They right. would give you one of the worst investments on the planet, by the way. But they would give you your the face value of the bond.
And zero risk.
At zero risk, right. Right now, when a new round, say, of 10-year treasuries or 5-year or 1-year or 30-year treasuries get issued, right, people from the get-go are just going to demand that they get a deeper discount. They buy it at a lower price, which means the effective rate is higher. They're inverse. Price and rate are inverse to each other. Because I know a lot of folks sometimes they get confused by this stuff, right? So now how does that affect the debt? So I'll throw some numbers at you, Mike, and then you can go again because that's what I do. I want to wind you up and have you go. The total obligations of the government are now at 122% of GDP, right? So plain terms, pretend that your salary is $100 a week. You get $100 every paycheck. What we're saying is that the money you would owe if you earned $100 a week is you would have to pay out $122 every week in debt. So what we're saying.
Yeah, let me offer a little bit of context. The GDP is how much you bring in a year. Let's do it on a yearly basis. I think it'll be a little bit easier for folks to, you know, get your head around. The amount of debt that the federal government has is 122% of that annual income.
Right. I annualized it down to a week. I made a mistake.
We're good. And that's total income for the whole country, not for the government.
Right.
Now, the 122 is a little bit on the high side because the government actually owns some of that. probably a more relevant number is around 100%. But it's this order of magnitude, right? It's around this ballpark. That the mortgage on the house is approximately equal to 1 year of income for our household.
Right.
The problem is that the federal government doesn't bring in all that income, which is actually a good thing. We don't want a government to bring in all of GDP into the government, right? We want that to be actually as small a piece as possible. But the relevant relationship is how much debt does the government have relative to the tax revenue that it brings in, right?
Right.
And the problem is that the debt is several times more, you know, 5-6 times the size of the amount of revenue that the government brings in. It's actually very, very large. It's hard to imagine the government will continue to be able to service this debt. Well, that's where we are today, which is not a good spot. The reason that Moody's has downgraded the debt is because the projections show that things are going to get worse, not just a little bit, but a lot worse. Let that sink in,
right.
And we'll talk about what we mean by that. And the other reason that Moody's is downgrading the creditworthiness of the government,
right,
is that there's no reason to believe the government's ever going to be able to get this under control, right? We've had Democrats in power, we've had Republicans in power, we've had one-party government, we've had two-party government, we've had COVID, we were pre-COVID, we were post-COVID, we've had recessions, we've had booms,
right,
and nothing seems to matter.
Right.
That keeps going up. There seems to be no political will,
right,
to take this on. When Thomas Massey says, this is a problem, I can't vote for this, the White House pummels him.
Right.
Instead of saying, the right answer is, we get it. We think that his concerns are overblown, which they're not,
right.
But I mean,
right.
That's the right answer. And we're having Thomas come over for lunch tomorrow, and we're going to negotiate this.
Right.
You don't say, the guy's an idiot, you know. They didn't say that. That's an exaggeration. But
they called him a grandstander. Trump,
they called him a grandstander. Well, yeah. Again, the problem is that for the maybe relatively small number of people in the United States,
right,
who are really tuned into this issue and control financial markets in New York, they know that he's not just a grandstander. They know he's right. And so when you say he's just a grandstander, it makes it look like you're just absolutely unaware of the problem, or to your point, being dishonest about it. So that's half of why Moody's has downgraded. And the other half is the numbers. So let me throw out another pair of numbers for
Please
you.
Please do. I'm a big numbers nerd. Go ahead.
Okay. One problem is that the amount of debt is going to increase from around 100% of annual GDP to around 135% of annual GDP in 10 years as projected. That's without the Trump tax cut extension.
Right.
That's with, you know, just under what current law looks like today. So that could easily get much, much worse. Okay, so that's a problem. But let me throw out another pair of numbers. The amount, the proportion of revenue that the federal government brings in dedicated to entitlements, right? Entitlements, Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and SNAP, food stamps,
right,
the whole enchilada. That's most of the money that the government has to pay out, right? That the government does pay out. The government has no flexibility about this. If the government were to say, we're not going to send out Social Security checks this week because we're trying to save a little money. No, somebody would sue in federal court and compel the Treasury Department to pay those. Those are legal entitlements. And that's what entitlements means. It means that the court believes that these people are entitled because it's a matter of law.
Right.
Federal law says the Treasury Department has to make these payments. It's not up to the White House or the Treasury Department or anybody else. Okay. Entitlement spending is most of what it pays. The proportion is going to increase from something like 76% to something like 85% over the next decade. Let that sink in, because I actually want to turn that around for dramatic effect.
Okay.
The amount of revenue that you have at your disposal is going to go from 24% of revenue to 15% of revenue. That's a big change, right? At the same time as the amount of interest you have to pay in the debt,
right,
goes from 18% to 30% of revenue. So the deficit, just never mind defense spending, never mind any discretionary spending whatsoever.
Right.
Just interest and entitlements are going to go from 18 for interest and 76 for entitlements. That's 94% of all revenue. So anything you spend on discretionary spending is, you know, going to trip you into a deficit, right?
Right.
That is going to go to 30 for interest and 85 for mandatory spending, entitlement spending, 115% of revenue plus any discretionary spending. You see the difference. I mean, this is not a difference in, oh, you know, we're going from a crappy situation that's, you know, an 8 to a crappy situation that it's a 9. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, right.
This is a difference in kind, in texture. Right. Very, very different situation. And so I don't think that many economists would look at that and say, just because we're doing okay now means that the government is going to be able to make its obligations 10 years from now. The two don't have a lot to do with each other. They're very, very different scenarios.
And Mike, like, this is the case of you going all Peter Schiff on this, right? This is more that it's just the numbers don't add up. And people have to understand this. This is not a political assessment necessarily when it comes to the dire straits we're in. Where the political assessment comes in when you're talking about the debt is, do people have the will to get it done? And clearly the answer is no. You mentioned that we have
up until now, it's been no, 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 and hell no.
Right. And part of the problem, which Milton Friedman pointed out as back as the 70s, if not sooner, is what do people want? Tax cuts. What do people also want? Free stuff from the government, using free in quotes. The two are diametrically opposed. So to the extent that you can grow the economy, say, by reducing the tax burden, especially on the producers of the nation, you can you can't do that simultaneously with tariffs, for example. So you're not growing the economy, or even if you do grow the economy, like what during the Reagan years, the economy grew, but spending outpaced that growth, and it outpaced. And typically, the way these things happen is, like all of us, we want the immediate gratification of tax cuts. We want the immediate gratification of free stuff. Well, when do we pay for it? Let's push it out 10 years because we won't be around from there. Even if we win two elections, if you're the president, you get 8 years in office consecutively. Pushing it out 10 years means it's always the other guy's problem. So politically, this is what brought us to this mess. There's no accounting. There's no accountability. You and I do plenty of accounting on what's wrong, but there's no accountability is what I meant to say.
Right.
And politically, it does take someone like a Massey. It does take someone like a Rand Paul who are going to stand up and say, this is not, or Chip Roy. Let me throw Chip Roy in there because he's very much a deficit hog. And it doesn't take a president who says, essentially, debt doesn't matter because we owe it to ourselves. Address that little bit of modern monetary theory, because we have heard the president say this, both on the campaign trail and in office, that, hey, debt means nothing because we owe it to ourselves. We can, you know, it's like owing yourself 10 bucks. You can decide not to pay yourself and not break your own legs for not paying yourself.
I think the fundamental problem with that is that it's not true.
Okay.
Right. The people who owe the debt and the people who are owed are two different groups of people.
Right.
you might argue, well, for the most part, it's Americans, but not completely. For the Chinese, for example, own a tremendous, the Europeans own a tremendous piece of the debt. Corporations, investment funds, individuals, it's spread out all over. So, you know, the argument would have to be something like, and there are people who say things like this, we could just default on the debt.
Yeah.
Right? That's the implication of, well, we owe it to ourselves. Okay. If the government defaults and just decides not to pay, I think that there's going to be, you know, two immediate problems.
Right.
One is all of that wealth, the holdings of Americans, American companies and investment funds and investors around the world, gets destroyed in some proportion, possibly in a large proportion. In other words, all of a sudden, a whole lot of millions of people feel less wealthy than they do today. Because today, if you've got $100,000 in treasury securities, you think you've got $100,000 of valuable stuff.
Right.
Exactly. And if you find out all of a sudden that the government has absolutely no interest in paying you, at least not 100 cents on the dollar, wow, I'm poorer. And possibly by significant amounts. And to say that, well, that's okay because we're going to have less taxes in the future. Boy, that argument's a stretch, right? You're going to tax us less because you're not going to meet the debt obligation. First of all, I wouldn't believe, I think that that's a whole lot of BS. No one's tested that theory. It's a Herculean lift. And I think that goes in the bucket of just stuff that isn't true. And the other thing that needs to be said is there is no intermediate position. You cannot default on a little bit of debt.
Right.
You cannot decide, well, we got $40 trillion in debt. You know, let's see how it goes for, you know, $1 trillion. We're going to skip the interest payment next week.
Right.
Because that means all of a sudden no one trusts you. No one should trust you. It's for cause. If you miss an interest payment, you're sending the signal that you don't believe making these payments is all that important.
Right.
Well, you know, when I was in banking back in the 13th century, it wasn't always just a matter of whether your client could pay you back. That's important.
Right.
But it's also a matter of would they? Are they willing to? Are they willing to do what it takes to pay you back? Because as soon as they miss one payment, now you got to worry. Right. Not only could it be a wealth problem or an income problem, it could also be just a I don't feel like paying you problem. And that's just as serious if you're at the other end of it. And of course, there's a mismatch between the group of people who would be taxed to bring the money in and the group of people who are holding treasury securities. So there's just no way to make everyone feel good about this. This is not a viable option. It's not serious. And I think it goes in the category, John, that we talk about every week, which is the White House is getting really bad staff work.
Yep, I agree.
Just profoundly bad staff work. It's okay for the CEO to float ideas, right? It's okay for – we all wish that Trump were more sophisticated when it came to finances, but, you know, we take what we get. It's okay on some level for the chief executive to say, well, you know, is it important? Does it matter? You know, what if we were to default? What happens if Moody's downgrades us? What do we do about that? Right. You know, he's got to be asking a lot of questions and challenging the status quo. You know, the one thing we do love about Donald Trump is that he challenges what it is that we've always been frustrated about, just the inertia of status quo thinking in the government. You know, we love that he's outside the box. But good staff work has to draw the distinction between you're outside the box, good for you, and you're outside of reality. This is how it actually works, right?
Right. You know, we like out-of-the-box thinking. We don't want thinking that leads us to contradict the laws of physics. Something to that effect, right?
So the laws of economics.
Right. We have to put the
precedent. Or the laws of the land when it comes to the Constitution.
Right. So we're happy that Trump is like, hey, why can't we do X, Y, Z? we would hope that someone has gotten to him ahead of time by saying XYZ is either impossible or illegal. So there's, to your point, change is required, but not all change is equivalent change. And I think that's what a lot of people on the right, and frankly, a lot of people who are caught up in this tide of not knowing who to believe and what to believe, that's what we in general struggle with. It's okay to challenge. It's not okay to weigh all options with equal validity, with equal seriousness. So when when we're talking about the debt, first and foremost, Mike, we've talked about it ad infinitum, and I can't stress this enough. No amount of tax cutting, no amount of tax increases to give the Keynesians their due. That's not going to solve the debt issue because there is no amount of taxation, considering that people can only be taxed up to 100%. They can take everything from us, Mike. And the debt would still not be significantly decreased. It has to come from the spending end, correct?
It does have to come from the spending end, and that is for the reason you point out that there's not enough money to be quickly taxed in order to take care of our debt problem. And the other problem is that a tax cut does not relieve your long-term tax burden.
Correct.
Your tax burden in the long run is every dollar the government spends. Every dollar the government spends is theft. You know, in the Libertarian Party, we have our favorite saying, taxation is theft.
Right.
And the reason we say that is because taxation is theft. But we need to recognize that all government spending is theft in that sense. All government spending has to be paid for by us, whether it's in the form of taxes now, inflation, which is a hidden tax on us all, and not so hidden when it's significant,
right?
Or long-term tax to take care of the debt. But there's no getting away from the fact that every dollar the government spends is a burden on us.
Truth.
And so when people talk about, will the Trump tax cuts get extended? I can't get excited about it one way or another.
Right.
I can't say, well, you know, that's exciting because we hate taxes and that would lower taxes. In the long run, it wouldn't lower taxes because you're not lowering spending. You're just delaying the tax and shifting it to someone else. Nor can I get excited about the opposite. Well, we're not going to extend the tax cut and therefore we're going to have more revenue coming in. I'm sorry. That doesn't do us any good, again, because you haven't cut spending.
Right.
You need to cut spending for the tax burden in the long run to be relieved. And I think, John, that it's important for us to point out at this point in our conversation two important things. Yeah. One, if the government doesn't do something really profound, really dramatic, either this week, which seems completely unlikely, as Moody's is pointing out,
right,
or next year, or in the next few years, the government of the United States, the federal government, financially speaking, will face a collapse.
Yeah.
That's not really conjecture. Opinion and conjecture is a matter of when that would happen.
Correct.
Right.
It's going to happen. It's just when.
It's going to happen if nothing else changes. It's only a matter of when. And when that happens, to get back to the question you posed several minutes ago, it would undermine, obviously, the market for all of federal debt.
Right.
You know, the turning point comes when investors figure out that the government is risky. Interest rates spike, the government can't make interest payments, and all of a sudden it has to default on something. When that happens, the entire bond market tanks, the bond market for treasury securities, for all government securities. And what that would mean is a contagion effect, which is to say investors would have a hard time discerning the risk of one class of securities versus another. In other words, they wouldn't trust bonds issued by counties and public municipalities and states either. they would recognize that the federal government being in financial trouble is probably going to lead to higher taxes, which is going to undermine the economy. Uh-oh. That spreads the contagion to all of our trading partners.
It's a global problem at that point.
It's a global problem. And the contagion effect works also through the idea of higher interest rates. Once interest rates go up, that means that there's a loss of wealth. People who are holding these treasury securities all of a sudden believe these treasury securities are worth a lot less. Right. They feel less wealthy. Well, what do, you know, people do when they feel less wealthy? They stop buying things. They stop investing.
Right.
This is an economic problem. And so the problem spreads not only from one class of investments to another. It would spread from treasury bonds to other government bonds to other bonds that are just corporate bonds. And then eventually, because corporations would be adversely affected by that,
right,
it would undermine the equities markets. That would undermine our economy, and therefore it would start spreading to other parts around the world.
It's just like the Great Depression, right? A lot of people assume that it was just a U.S. thing.
Yeah.
But really, the U.S. exported its depression worldwide.
Absolutely.
In the 1920s. So,
and today, we are an even larger proportion of the world economy than we were then.
Right.
We're the number one trading partner. We're the number one trader of investments. We make most foreign direct investments.
Right.
And we bring in more foreign direct investments than anyone else.
And correct me if I'm wrong. In 1929, when the Great Depression hit, the U.S. dollar was not the reserve currency. It was the pound sterling.
That's exactly right.
So it'd be even more multiplied because the thing that would collapse is what the rest of the world uses to settle its debts, right? So that's what we mean, to go back to the opening statement. That's what we mean by a reserve currency, for those that aren't familiar with the term. It's the rest of the world. Like when the Chinese in Europe trade and they're trading, or I should say the Japanese in Europe, say the yen and the euro, net-net, they settle out in dollars because dollars are considered the safest currency. So
yep.
People say, okay, after all the conversions and currency exchanges, what does it mean in dollars? That gives the U.S. dollar and the U.S. economy.
And they literally hold dollars. You know, they hold dollars for purposes of transactions. They hold dollar-denominated assets.
For safety.
Because it's considered the safest.
Yeah.
And the value of the dollar is a matter of supply and demand. And most of the value of the dollar is in the U.S. economy. Most dollars are used in the U.S. economy. So if the U.S. economy tanks, that immediately brings down the value of the dollar, which would make investors all over the world feel less wealthy.
And
so that's the transmission.
And we saw that in 2008 to a lesser degree than in 1929. But we got a taste of it, and it wasn't a good taste that was left in most of our mouths. Okay, Mike. So I want to just speed it along a little bit, because when we were texting back and forth, as I'm wont to do, I talk too much and I text too much when we do this prior to the taping. But one of the things you brought up to me, which I hadn't considered, which I kind of kick myself for not thinking of this, is the point you made of, talk to me philosophically what it means if the U.S. economy were to collapse. I never considered it from this perspective, but when you mentioned it, man, it sent shivers.
Well, there is, a conversation going on in the world regarding authoritarianism and regarding democracy. Vladimir Putin has many times over the years said that democracy doesn't work very well.
Right.
And he's justifying his own position as someone who has quite a bit of control over his government.
Right.
And through the oligarchs and through his government, still maintains quite a bit of control over his economy. It is a market economy in Russia, much more so than it used to be. But let's not kid ourselves. It's controlled by a relatively small number of people compared to, say, the economy of the United States.
As is China.
China is even more so, right? The government controls almost everything that goes there. You wouldn't want to cross the Russian government if you were a businessman in Russia. And in China, for example, it's hard to even imagine how a businessman would cross the Chinese government. You know, if you got it in your head Monday morning you wanted to, I don't think you would make it to Tuesday's lunch.
Right.
So these are economies in which they're not trying to move toward democracy.
Right.
They're building the argument the way that we do business works best, and the way that democracies work isn't very good.
Right.
And this is an argument that we believe we won a long time ago, right?
Right, right.
You know, we start out this story with the Enlightenment in 1776, the American Revolution, the Declaration of Independence, and then the Constitution, and then the French Revolution, and the Europeans adopt this, and then the Latin Americans eventually adopt that, and we're off to the races, and we defeat poverty, and we eventually get to a more peaceful world.
Right.
We won the conversation. That's the typical libertarian narrative. If the U.S. economy collapses because the American government collapses,
right,
demonstrating that the American government cannot control itself when it comes to spending and borrowing, someone like Vladimir Putin, if this happens quickly, it'll literally be Vladimir Putin.
Right.
But assuming it takes a while for this to happen, whoever replaces Putin is going to say, I told you so. And that is going to be an important moment.
Right.
Because every authoritarian around the world, including a bunch of authoritarians working inside of democracies,
yes, sir,
are going to say, Putin was right, not Thomas Jefferson. And that's a problem that sets back our economy, not the couple of decades that we are going to lose in terms of human development if the U.S. government collapses, but many decades, which is why I truly believe that the reason that we need to fix this problem is because we are battling not only for the remainder of the 21st century, but for arguably the 22nd century. In other words, this is a very, very long-term problem. We have built up all these good feelings about democracy for 200 years. A lot of that is because of the participatory nature. We all like to feel smart. We get to vote. So, you know, this is a great thing. But a piece of that has also been it works.
Right.
We've been successful. We've built up our income. Our government has run pretty well compared to, this is hard for a libertarian to say, but our government has worked pretty well compared to a lot of other governments.
Right. It's the best game going.
The best game going, as bad as democracy is, right?
Right.
You know, Churchill used to say, democracy is the worst kind of government, except for all the others.
Well, except for all the others, right.
You know, I think that's probably a good summation.
Right.
If we fail at this, we will have interrupted the history of our species by a couple of hundred years with democracy, but there'll be a very strong push to go back to whatever it was before 1776. I don't mean monarchies, but the push for authoritarianism would be very difficult for the world to resist in a massive depression.
Yeah, and we kind of see it now, right? We, like, even within our own society, there is a large chunk that thinks we'd be better off with a strong man on top. I think that's, I will always maintain that that's part of the appeal Donald Trump has. Whereas other presidents had the hidden strongman agenda, Trump is very open about it. I don't know if that makes it better or worse, but that appeals to a lot of people. There's a significant chunk of people who want to see Trump rule by executive order, as he has done in his second term. Nothing has been accomplished legislatively. We have the horrible combination of Trump's first, 120 days or so. He's issued the most EOs in history. And conversely, Congress has passed the fewest amount of bills in history over that same amount of time, despite the fact of Republicans controlling both branches of government. So,
well said. And interestingly, the big argument from the what breaks my heart about the Democratic Party, of which I am not a part, but what breaks my heart about this loyal opposition is that the big debate inside the Democratic Party is, we wish we had been stronger during the Biden years. That now we're finding out that the Biden administration was run by a committee, right? Not by the president. And the big lament is that didn't let us be as strong as we want. Not that we were doing the wrong things.
Right.
That we didn't have enough.
We want our own Donald Trump. It's basically what they're saying. You know,
that's basically what they're saying. They're not saying, oh, you know, the student loan thing, that was stupid.
Right.
Or the lockdowns, that was stupid. Or our leaning into the leftist culture wars, that was stupid. No, 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 that's not what they're saying. They're saying we should have been stronger if only we had a stronger guy at the center instead of, you know, an aging president.
And to wrap it up, that is precisely why libertarians are so against even benign dictators, even benevolent dictators, because at the end of the day, they're still dictators. You're still dependent on one person determining the outcome of your life. And that's what we stand opposed to. So while Mike Termott and I can sit here and pick out some good things President Trump has done and some good initiatives that he's put on the ground, it does matter. You do have to show your work as to how you got there, why you got there. And so to wrap it up, but the debt, to Mike's point, which I thank him tremendously for sort of opening my eyes to, the debt is not just an economic issue that will affect our pockets. Potentially, it threatens us to throw us into another dark ages where we say we are looking for our benevolent dictator. We are looking for a Putin or Ceausescu or a President Xi or whatever. We are looking for these strongmen. And unfortunately, as we saw after the Great Depression, you do get strongmen. You do get your Mussolinis. You do get your Hitlers. And during the Cold War, we saw the same.
Well, that's true. And John, let me leave you with one final thought.
Sure.
I do believe that there are four major threats to the government. One is the debt crisis. One is militaristic interventions that don't go well and triggers a major war. One is a downward spiral of civil unrest and martial law. The fourth is AI. And I would invite everyone listening to us today to consider the following weird scenario, which I think we would have considered ultra weird a couple of years ago.
Right.
But consider how weird is the following. The federal government of the United States collapses 15 years from now, right? And a whole lot of people ask AI, what's the best type of government? What is AI going to say, A, and B, what's AI going to do about it?
That is, it's an interesting interesting question, Mike. There's no doubt about that. And maybe the next Liberty Lens will focus on AI. Maybe we'll try to get to the bottom of that. But as for this, this episode, I want to thank my co-host and friend Mike Termott for helping me understand why the debt and debt management and trying to knock down this national debt is so critical, not just for the United States' immediate future, but the future literally of liberty and democracy, I think. It's not an overstatement. It may be a little heavy-handed right at this moment, but think ahead 10 years, 15 years, and maybe it isn't as heavy-handed as it seems today. For Mike Termott over there and myself, we'll catch you next week right here on Liberty Lens on grumblingsmedia.com. Until then, peace, everyone.